I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum program this evening. The Independent Policy Forum is a series of lectures, debates, and seminars that we hold regularly here at the Institute's Conference Center in Oakland. As you know, tonight our topic is why are the public schools failing and what can be done? For those of you who are new to the Institute, hopefully you got a registration packet when you did register, and there's information in there about our many books and other publications, future events. There's a flyer you'll find in there on tonight's program, and the next event, which we'll be holding here, is on August 14th with Larry Elder, who is a syndicated columnist and talk show host, and his topic will be Truth and Propaganda in Politically Correct America. So, the usual Larry Elder provocative topic. We also invite you to become a member of the Institute, and there are all sorts of great benefits, of course, in addition to joining with us in what we do and becoming a supporter of our program. After our program in August, the next event will be probably in September. It's not absolutely confirmed, with the renowned psychiatrist Thomas Zaws and his new book called Pharmacracy, which is a blistering critique of the healthcare nanny state. Tom had a very good article in the past issue, not the current issue, but the past issue of our quarterly journal, The Independent Review. And I also wanted to show you, this is a previous issue of The Independent Review, which features an article by one of our speakers, John Merrifield. And if you're interested in this issue, which has a number of pieces on school issues, we can certainly arrange for you to obtain a copy. Also in your packet, you'll find information about a program that we hold each summer for high school students, which is this flyer here called the Summer Seminars in Political Economy. The program is going to be held, the next program will be actually in August, mid-August, and it's the 13th through the 17th. This year it's being co-sponsored by Holy Name College here in Oakland, so for those students who are from out of the area, they can stay at Holy Name. And also they can sign up for a one-hour college course credit in economics. The instructor for the program is here tonight, Professor Joe Furig, who is someplace here, there he is. Joe is at the Department of Economics at Golden Gate University and also at the University of San Francisco. So it's a program that I highly recommend for anyone who has children who are in high school or early college. It's a program that is designed to create a foundation of understanding the world that we live in, and the chances are very high that otherwise students will not get that in the school, which is part of our topic tonight. This evening, as you know, we're here to discuss one of the most serious and widespread problems in American society, the failing performance of the public school system. For decades, reformers have promised to improve the public schools, but by and large, the costs continue to escalate, while the quality continues to decline. A few recent newspaper headlines might give you an example of some of this. One read, "Threshold lowered on exit exams. State okays high school standards below what was originally proposed." Another read, "Abysmal exit test results for ninth graders. Most flunk if 70% is a passing grade." Another read, "Small wars plague the schools. Teachers, district, mayor embroiled." Another read, "Schools add security in reaction to violence." And one of my favorites from San Francisco was, "30% of school funding missing." And it was followed up with a series that you may have seen, $60 million misspent by four consecutive San Francisco school chiefs. I don't know, if I was in business and that happened, I think some changes would happen, but I guess not. So why have efforts to improve the public school system been such failures? As the public schools have become more bureaucratized and politicized, is there something systemic in the way the schools are structured that is creating such outcomes? Which approaches are more likely to overcome the political and other obstacles to improve education? Which approaches best ensure that schools will be held accountable to parents and teachers? Which approaches have the greatest potential for fostering educational excellence? These are some of the issues that we'll try to discuss this evening. And to explore these two questions, we have two excellent scholars with us. I hope everyone here will get a chance to pick up their two books that we're featuring. One is called The School Choice Wars by John Merrifield, and the other one has a provocative topic title called Can Teachers Own Their Own Schools? Our first speaker is Richard Vedder. Richard is a senior fellow here at the Independent Institute. He's also a distinguished professor of economics at Ohio University. He's the author, as I just mentioned, of this monograph book called Can Teachers Own Their Own Schools? Professor Vedder is also co-author with Lowell Galloway, also at Ohio University, of the Independent Institute book Out of Work, Unemployment and Government in 20th Century America. It was a recipient of both the 1994 Sir Anthony Fisher International Memorial Award and the 1994 Mencken Award finalist for Best Book. Professor Vedder received his PhD in economics from the University of Illinois, and he's been a senior economist at the U.S. Joint Economic Committee and a visiting fellow at the Center for the Study of American Business at Washington University. He's the author of many top books, especially in economic history, and labor economics. His hundreds of articles and reviews have appeared in an enormous number of scholarly journals. He's also the author of pieces in such publications as the Wall Street Journal, the Christian Science Monitor, and many other places. I'm very pleased to have dear colleague, Rich Vedder.
Thanks, David. It's a real joy to be here with you. I've been associated with David Thoreau one way or the other for close to 20 years. It's hard to believe. There's very few people in America. I'd put him in the top, if not dozen, two dozen people in America in terms of promoting individual liberty and freedom in a very responsible fashion. And it's always a delight to be with David and Mary Thoreau and others at the Independent Institute who are doing such a wonderful job. I was reminded coming here tonight that it's to show how bad American education is. The most interesting idea that I received recently about how to improve public schools came not from a politician, came not from George Bush, did not come from Al Gore, did not come from the governor of California, Davis Gray or Gray Davis or whatever his name is, but came from Vladimir Putin. I was in the this is true. I was in the Kremlin meeting with Mr. Putin last year, and Mr. Putin, who has severe financial problems, out of desperation says, "You know, I think we're going to have to do something about our schools, and I think we're going to start charging tuition in our schools." Well, it's a start, you know. And have you ever heard an American politician suggest that? Anyway, so when we look to the Russians for guidance in anything, you know we've got problems. Speaking of the Russians, let's go back to October 4th, 1957, more than 43 years ago. The Soviet Union launched Sputnik that day. And from that, Americans interpreted that as a sign that we were lagging behind in technology, we were lagging behind in education, and that our education system must be failing because we're behind the Russians in space. And out of that came a whole new bunch of federal programs, National Defense Education Act, and so on, and whatnot. Then move forward another generation to 1983. A government commission issued a Nation at Risk that said that America was doing a poor job in educating its children, and the nation's economic and cultural leadership were at peril because of this deficiency. Now come forward nearly another generation to now, July 2001. The evidence is, as David pointed out, that educational performance has little changed since the Nation at Risk was issued 18 years ago, with very modest improvement in some indicators and none at all on others. And in international tests, such as the TIMSS mathematical examination, American students are in the second tier of nations, down below some of the very poorest of nations. We, for example, consistently score lower than Hungary or Korea on these testing. Indeed, a good case can be made that today's students learn less than their grandparents did in the early post-war era. SAT scores, for example, are now lower than they were in the 1960s. Yet it is not for lack of financial effort. Real per capita spending has tripled, roughly, in public schools since 1960. In economic terms, productivity has fallen by about two-thirds, at a time when the productivity in the broader economy has more than doubled. It actually takes a larger portion of the nation's output to educate one public school child today than it did in 1960, despite massive economic growth. And we have little or nothing to show for it. The inputs into producing educational services have tripled per student, but the outputs have remained at best unchanged. The productivity of schools relative to the economy as a whole has fallen by at least a factor of six, with the possible exception of prostitution. Teaching is the only profession that I know that has had absolutely no productivity advance in the 2,400 years since Socrates taught the youth of Athens. And I'm not so sure about prostitution. Now, supporters of public schools would disagree with the notion that the public schools are failing on at least two grounds. First, of course, the measurement of outcomes of education is difficult, and learning takes many forms other than those measured by standardized tests. There are non-intellectual objectives to schools, we are told, such as promoting physical development, appreciation of the arts, promoting self-esteem, that's a big one these days, and a sense of civic virtue, a little one these days. Second, the environment in which we live has changed to in a way that discourages learning. For example, the decline in the traditional two-parent nuclear family have had negative effects on student performance. And these criticisms or these points have some surface validity to them, but they're essentially excuses for the current mediocrity of the school. I believe the public believes that the overwhelming purpose of public schools is to provide universal instruction in the core subject areas. It is not to develop self-esteem, serve as a welfare agency, and so forth. There's no way of measuring it, but I would suspect that today's young kids feel about as good about themselves, whatever that means, as the ones did 40 years ago, are roughly as patriotic, probably a little less honest and respectful of others, but for reasons related to the general decline in the nuclear family, decline of religion, and so on. In short, educational outcomes have not improved over time by any measure, and there's no legitimate excuse for America's poor test scores relative to other countries or for the poor performance of public schools relative to private ones in the United States. So, why have our government schools failed? The answer is as simple as A, B, C. As to the A, as David mentioned, the schools lack accountability. Bad performance is not punished. Good performance is not rewarded. As to the B, the regulatory barriers to doing a good job are immense. Good persons can't teach because they haven't taken some inane education courses required to get a teaching certificate. Great teachers can't lecture to big groups because of class size limits imposed by state mandates, and so on. The list goes on and on. And of course, as to the C, consumers of education lack choice in many areas, that is to say, there's a lack of meaningful competition. In reality, American schools, to go back to my initial point, American schools conform more to the Soviet industrial model of, say, 1970 than to the competitive American market model of today. Like Soviet industry, American schools tend to be government-owned and operated monopolies, governed in large part by distant bureaucracies. And like Soviet industry, performance is measured in physical units with little regard for quality. As in the Soviet era, American schools are inefficient with no incentives to become more so. And like in Soviet Russia, the consumer is not sovereign and is even largely ignored. Shortly after the Russian Revolution, the great Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises predicted the eventual demise of the command socialist economy. Mises argued that there could be no economic calculation under socialism, that is to say, businesses could not make efficient resource allocation decisions given the lack of a market signals, incentives, and the like. During the 1920s and 30s, Mises and Friedrich Hayek, whose picture is upstairs, I think on the wall, right back here in the corner, debated opponents on this point. And ultimately, as Mises and Hayek predicted, Soviet-style socialism did disappear with a whimper, not a bang. Will the same thing happen to the modern American counterpart, government schools? The demise of public schools is less clearly predictable, but the forces that Mises and Hayek talked about are operating to undermine the vitality of government education. American education does have a significant private component, although you could argue so did Soviet Russia with its private vegetable plots of farmers. In a sense, homeschooling is to America what the vegetable plots were to the Soviet economy of the 1970s. There's a bunch of homeschoolers here, and that's the best analogy I can come up with. For the efficient market-based sector in America has the ability, of course, to subsidize this inefficient government school sector indefinitely, at a very real cost. However, I will predict that over time, several forces will be at working to increase the popularity of private education, including for-profit schools, leading to some decline and possibly the ultimate demise of public schools as we know them today. Let's, before we do that, talk about an alternative way of practicing privatizing public education. Let's talk about several ways. First, the least radical approach, of course, is for public schools to simply contract out some services to private companies. Many public schools do that already to some extent with food and transportation and maintenance services. They could extend this, however, and some have, to other areas of instruction or even to running the entire schools, turning over the schools to private companies. Another approach, of course, is to provide consumers with scholarship or vouchers in enabling them to attend private schools, something that John Merrifield knows a great deal about, reducing the incremental cost to consumers of that form of education. A third public policy option that is gaining some favor is to grant tax credits to cover part or all of private educational expenses. This, too, increases the relative attractiveness of private schools. A fourth approach is to encourage rather than discourage homeschooling of children. today I want to mention, just for the sake of discussion this evening, an approach for private education that may have some potential, at least warrant some experimentation. In greater detail on my little approach that I'm going to suggest tonight and its limitations, which are real, can be found in the book that David mentioned, Can Teachers Own Their Own Schools, that Independent has published. Let's imagine a medium-sized city that feels its schools are not living up to its potential and that the school board somehow miraculously agrees with this assessment. I served 4 years on a public school board and had to quit because I was going to get cirrhosis of the liver if I had continued. It really drove me to drink. It was quite an experience. Anyway, let's suppose this mythical city has tremendous labor problems with the teacher unions. Acrimony is running high. Test scores are running low. How could privatization solve its problem? The school board goes to the teachers and says, we're going to give you the schools. They're yours. We're going to turn over the title to the buildings, the equipment, the supplies to you. We're even going to give you some money. Here's how it's going to work. We're going to set up, let's say there are 5 elementary schools in this town. We're going to set up 5 for-profit corporations, one for each school. Let's say each has 400 kids in it. And let's say the community's per pupil education costs at the elementary level are $5,000. So that's $10 million that they're currently spending on elementary schools. Now we're going to give... we're going to create the Washington Corporation, the Adams Corporation, the Jefferson Corporation, the Madison Corporation, the Monroe Corporation. I named these after our first 5 presidents. And let's say we're going to give each teacher 100 shares of stock in the corporation where she or he teaches for each year that they've taught in the school. We're going to give the principal 200 shares. We're going to give the janitors and other support staff 50 shares. In an elementary school, say with 24 teachers, a principal, and 10 support staff, perhaps 36,000 shares would go to the teachers, 4,000 to the principal, 5,000 to the support staff, or 45,000 shares altogether. If the building and so on is worth $2.7 million, that's a book value of $60 a share. Suppose we're going to try to sell another 15,000 shares, either to staff members who want to buy more shares or to the public at $50 a piece. So that'll raise some more working capital for the school, $750,000. So the school board will then sign a contract with a school corporation guaranteeing that for not less than 5 years that it will give $5,000 in annual scholarship to each child that attends this school with some increments in payments in future years. Now, this is vouchers system in sense, and I have mixed feelings about vouchers in some ways, but I'm just throwing this idea out just for discussion. There will be a number of interesting transition problems to the system such as I'm proposing. I won't go into them here. You've certainly got to get rid of existing collective bargaining agreements. They must be made null and void. Education regulations of the state must be declared inapplicable, and so on. There are issues relating to pension benefits and so on. I won't go into all those. Now, the schools can charge any tuition they want. To attract more students than the existing 400, then one school might want to be the cheap school in town, charging only $4,800 in tuition. The parents get a $5,000 voucher, they pay $4,800 in school, they pocket $200 and go to the liquor store. I don't know what they do. And that's what the public school advocates will tell you they're going to do it. Another school might claim it is offering superior services and charge $5,200 in tuition. Now, in order to cut costs, in order to make a profit, one school might use some of its cash to buy out some ineffective older senior teachers who are a drag, but expensive. Say, replacing $50,000 a year teachers with new blood at new teachers making $25,000 or $30,000 a year. Perhaps a school, my wife's a guidance counselor, my wife's sitting in the back and been in the school business for 30 years. I incidentally have a public school son, a teacher who's a son, a daughter who's a public school teacher, a daughter-in-law who's a public school teacher. I am inundated, surrounded by these people. So maybe instead of hiring a new elementary guidance counselor for $40,000 a year, this school will hire a retired social worker for $25,000. Instead of hiring a professional librarian for the school library, they'll talk one of the a mother of a parent to doing it for $10 an hour. So the school will find ways to economize. One school, in order to attract students, might hire a highly popular teacher away from another school and give them a signing bonus of $5,000. And a slightly higher salary. Another school might move to offer a traditional curriculum based on core knowledge of E.D. Hirsch or the Saxton math curriculum or something. Well, another school might offer a progressive curriculum, whatever that means. One might require students to wear uniforms and have strict discipline, and the other might say, do your own things, kids. Another school might move to a faith-based curriculum. In short, each school will have incentives to cut costs and provide a curriculum and school environment that appeals to a large number of parents. Now, teachers will require valuable assets. In the example I gave, in some cases worth $100,000 or more, in some cases doubling or tripling the net worth of the teacher. Yet they will give up all the protections that they have as public employees. Tenure will end unless the teacher's stockholders agree to keep it. The scheme, in effect, bribes the educational establishment to change its way. In the new environment, unions become almost irrelevant as teachers own a majority of the stock in the school and, in effect, work for themselves. In a sense, this is an ESOP, or Employment Stock Ownership Plan proposal. Presumably, in such a system, costly educational fads, which come every 2 or 3 years down the pike. Have you noticed that, how they keep coming down every few years? Whole language, 1 year. What is it? Block scheduling. Do you know what block scheduling is? Block scheduling is big this year. I don't know why, but for some reason. Teach kids in 2-hour increments. Great idea for 13-year-olds. Teach them 2 hours the same subject. Wonderful idea. Anyway. We have schemes. Reduce class size. Rather than reducing class size, our employee-owned school will probably increase class size in order to increase profits and do so by hiring more lower-cost teacher aides and tutors. Greater use would be made of distance learning. So we do actually introduce real technology change into teaching. So this is what I propose, and I have more on this, but I want you to hear John in a minute, so I'm going to stop on that. Let me turn, though, for a moment to the growth in for-profit education in the United States, because that's what I'm proposing. Incidentally, the schools I'm proposing ultimately would probably find they need to have strong management and might amalgamate or merge into something like Edison Schools, or the noble learning communities, or some of the for-profit schools in America today. But it should be noted that in the United, I'm an economic historian. I have to make this point. Jeff Hummel's here, a great economic historian in the audience, by the way, back there. A guy who's writing the crackerjack stuff on slavery in the United States, the best stuff around. But as an economic historian, I have to know that both in the United States and in Great Britain, the Industrial Revolution had largely been completed before education became a public venture. Education was a private venture when England had the Industrial Revolution. England was the first nation in the world ever to get an income level way beyond what we might think of as subsistence on a sustained basis that has been sustained for hundreds of years. And it happened when the educational system was private, not public. There was no government money in education in England before 1830 and very little before 1850. So the country became the world's leading economic power. 80% of the adults learned to read and write before they had public schools. And in America, it's more complicated, but essentially the same pattern, a little less clear. But up to the Civil War, the bulk of education in the United States was private. Now, we've had a revival of interest in private education, homeschooling being a great example, but also for-profit schools are making a dramatic growth in the last few years. In August of 1999, for this book, I went to Yahoo Finance under their category schools on the computer, and I added up the market capitalization of every company listed as a school by Yahoo Finance. At the time, there were 22. The value of all of those companies, capitalization, market capitalization, was $7.4 billion. I did the same thing 2 weeks ago. The capitalization was $15.4 billion. At a time that the NASDAQ, which most of these companies are listed on the NASDAQ, these are publicly listed companies. This excludes a lot of private companies, privately held companies. The NASDAQ, where most of these companies are listed, decline in value. The Dow Jones stayed constant. So in this period where the stock market is at best holding even and maybe declining, we have more than the doubling in the market capitalizations of companies. Sales in those 2 years rose by 55%. They're going up 25% a year. And that's gone on at least 3 years that we know of and longer. So this is a miniature dot-com kind of industry going on. Incidentally, these companies collectively earned last year more than $100 million in profits, just marginally over $100 million, but their market capitalization's $15 billion, which tells you that the price-earnings ratio on average for these companies is more than 100 to 1. Now, this suggests that the market has a very high assessment or the future of these companies, or otherwise it wouldn't, the stock prices wouldn't be so high. Now, the stock market occasionally misjudges things. Some people know. Incidentally, one company in the group, the largest single company in the group, in the 3 weeks since I did this calculation, has had its own market capitalization grow by more than $1 billion. That's Apollo Group. What does Apollo Group do? University of Phoenix. Now, the University of Phoenix Apollo Group is like many of the companies. They're not operating in the traditional K through 12 market. We're providing services either for younger or older persons, especially college age. There are 116,000 students now at the University of Phoenix. Other companies like Sylvan Learning Systems provide supplemental instruction for K through 12 students, but not run many schools. Now, there are schools, Edison Schools, Noble Learning Communities are two I mentioned, that operate specifically in the K through 12 market. Now, the main reason why the college for-profit market is succeeding even more than the K through 12 one is that public colleges and universities charge tuition, often thousands of dollars annually, while the K through 12 schools do not. Since there's a lot of subsidization of graduate education within public universities, often there's very little state subsidy provided for basic freshman and sophomore level education. I suspect even at Berkeley, which is a good school, the freshman and sophomore, the cost of educating one more freshman at Berkeley is pretty low. They use grad students to teach most of them, so on. Anyway, David has a son at Berkeley, so I make this point. Anyway, moreover, massive price discrimination by the public universities, which they call scholarships, I call price discrimination, means that upper and middle income students pay dramatically more tuition than lower income students. Thus, private schools can often charge some students only modestly more than what the public schools do and offer an appealing curriculum. Now, there are five reasons why I think interest in for-profit schools may grow over time, even at the K through 12 level. Let me mention them. I'm 85% done, if you're getting tired. With my students, who I have some control over that I give grades to, you know, I can browbeat them into sitting here, but you have the ability to get up and walk out, which scares the hell out of me. So, I'm trying to keep you awake. Now, over time, first point I would make in this regard is that over time, the increase in real incomes per capita, which have been going on for since at least 1840, a feature of American economic history for the last two centuries, that this trend will continue. And as parents get wealthier, they want more for their kids, and they're increasingly willing to pay and make big sacrifices to give their children an extra advantage. In a sense, homeschooling is a manifestation of that. Thus, they're more and more willing to shell out thousands of dollars to places like the Edison Project or Edison School in order to educate their children. Second, there is a nationwide movement to minimize spending differentials between public schools, of which California, of course, led the way, Sorrento versus Priest, way back when, late 70s. This aggravates the already existing willingness of affluent parents to send their kids to private schools, and in some cases to engage in homeschooling. The good suburban schools aren't quite as good anymore because of these various spending limits that are put on them. They're taxed to fund the poorer schools. Third, voter support for public schools is based on a basic assumption that these schools are delivering needed services at a reasonable cost. The sharp decline in efficiency of public schools has increased voter willingness to experiment with alternative forms of educational delivery, such as vouchers and tax credits and so forth, moves that probably lower the financial costs of for-profit education relative to publicly provided alternatives. And incidentally, another factor, and as one who is marginally on senior citizen status myself, I'm becoming more aware of, that as our population ages, we are having an increasing number of voters who are resistant to funding schools because they're, you know, they have no children and so forth in the schools themselves. And related to that point, it is evident that there's more and more research that the public is learning about by people like Peterson and Green and all, which this is, one could be skeptical of some of it, but it does suggest that people that are going to private schools that are funded in an alternative way are sometimes liking them more. Minority students in Milwaukee, for example, John is critical of the Milwaukee experiment, but I'll mention that, you know, the studies show that minority students in Milwaukee attending private schools financed by, in part by vouchers, tend to learn more math and so forth. So all of these things are making the public more willing to consider alternatives to the current paradigm. And over time, and I owe this idea to my colleague Josh Hall, who's sitting in the back, also an educational researcher, the number of public school districts has declined, leading to a reduction in choice for citizens, the consolidation movement, to consolidate districts. So it's not as easy as it used to be to move, to send your kid to another school, because you got to go farther away, and that often conflicts with jobs and so forth. History tells us that inefficiencies and absurdities can exist for a long time where the public sector is involved. How long did it take us to get rid of welfare? I mean, well, we haven't, but I mean, at least, how long did it take us to even start to do anything about welfare? What, 50 years, 60 years? But at some point, either economics or politics or both, sometime forces true reforms. Reform of the public schools has been much discussed, and there's been much activity, but very little results. In part, that's because some of the so-called reforms are really attempts by vested interests to increase their funding. The move to promote smaller class size fits into this category. The evidence is class size reduction is extremely expensive and generally ineffective way of improving learning. Yet the unions, of course, have embraced this reform with a vengeance. Modest reforms have been adopted, increasing accountability, reducing barriers, and increasing choice, and standards have been ostensibly raised. Yet all of this reminds me of Mikhail, going back to my Russian example again, of Mikhail Gorbachev and perestroika and glasnost. Remember perestroika and glasnost? Ineffectual attempts to apply little bandages to a gaping wound. Like painting the rails of the Titanic during its maiden voyage. The system of public schooling faces fundamental flaws that minor tinkering will not fix. One way that the Russians may transition peacefully from communism was by bribing the apparatchiks who control the party and businesses in the old regime. The bribes came in the form of almost free grants of shares in new companies and enterprises. The results haven't been perfect. The Russians now, though, at least get goods in their stores, they can travel, and they can make consumer choices. Perhaps we should learn from the Russians. Make peace with our enemies. approve education reform by bribing them. My idea is of turning schools over to the educrats may not be perfect, but it might provide a means of fomenting what Lowell Galloway and I have called war between the rent seekers, dividing the rank and file teachers from their union bosses. If we can offer teachers something tangible, perhaps they will embrace attempts to introduce into education the forces of the market and competitive capitalism that have made us the wealthiest land that the world has ever known. Thank you.